This is KPDO 89.3 FM serving Pescadero and the South Coast. And my guest today is Stephen Mintz, who has written a book on polarization and cancel culture. And he's going to be discussing what he's found in the course of his research with all of us. And I think we all have an interest in this subject. We've seen it at work. So, Dr. Mintz, should I call you Dr. Mintz or should I call you Steve?
Oh, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. So what's the name of your book to start with?
It's called Beyond Happiness and Meaning, Transforming Your Life Through Ethical Behavior.
So the ethical behavior, I suppose, is the part where cancel culture comes in. Is that it?
Exactly. Okay. Yes.
So, and then you mentioned that this is on social media. So is this a result of social media that, you know, we have cancel culture, do you think?
I think that's a big part of it. People have instant access to social media. And if they want to criticize an individual or a group for something they said or did, it's pretty easy to do so these days. And it's also anonymous. So It makes it more likely people will speak out about events they disagree with.
You know, to give an example, I was recently reading about how in the New York City mayoral contest, they have a few people who are running, and people took sides in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has nothing to do with New York per se, but obviously there's a lot of Jewish people in New York. We all know that. And in this particular case, one of the candidates, Andrew Yang, had said, you know, I support Israelis who are under bombardment by these rockets. And then everybody got upset because he hadn't also said something about the Palestinians. So then he said, I'm sorry, you're right. I should have said that I support anyone, you know, who's being bombarded or something like that. But he was already canceled, right? A lot of people said, oh, well, we can't vote for a person who would support Israelis, even if they then modify their words. And this is a real example of how here's a person who, you know, seems to have a good intention of helping people with universal basic income and things like that. But on this unrelated subject, he made a pronouncement people disagreed with, and suddenly he was canceled for a lot of people. They just wouldn't vote for him because of this unrelated issue. And then when the fact that he'd then modified it didn't seem to register. It's like, no, once you've said these words that we disagree with, you disappear from our consciousness, even if you modify your stance to be more inclusive. And it was like amazing to me. It was a little bit shocking to see that, wow, this is how cancel culture works. You know, you just take a person right off your list of people who live or exist. It's just amazing to me.
Yeah. So, it doesn't promote dialogue and interchange rather than trying to understand each other and have a productive dialogue. Right. That's not part of the cancel culture.
Yeah. So it is pervasive, and I'm surprised at it. I'm also seeing it even in our rural communities where if you weren't a Trump supporter, for example, people don't want to talk to you. It's a different version of cancel culture, but it's sad, and it's not helpful in our society. So do you have some sort of idea of how to get beyond this?
Well, I think we need our leaders in Congress especially to model good behavior and show us how we can dialogue with each other in a productive way. And right now that's not happening. Right. We have a very divided country. It seems every issue that comes up for consideration or vote It goes according to party lines. So we don't really see folks in Congress being open to dialogue from other points of view. So we get the impression that it's almost not doable, or at least those who we would hope would be able to do it do not. Mm-hmm. So until there's sensitivity to that issue, I don't think anything will change.
Well, I think there's some things maybe we can do as individuals to try to get it started. I mean, one of the things that I have tried to focus on is watching, I wouldn't say bipartisan news, but trying to watch different angles of the news or different information sources so that I'm not in a little echo chamber. And I have learned a lot over the last couple of years from doing that, and realized, you know, that what the stereotypes are and why different parties have those stereotypes, try to get beyond that, you know. But I was hoping maybe you had some sources of news that were bipartisan or neutral. Do you know of such sources?
No, I don't. I can't say that I can off the top of my head. I mean, I think this country is so polarized, we don't even think about things in those terms anymore. So what can one group say negatively about the other group? And basically, it just becomes a kind of an ethical slippery slope. And before you know it, you know, everybody is canceled out for something or another. And if you don't go along with the prevailing culture, then you could be canceled. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a form of political correctness on steroids, which is how it all got started, through political correctness.
Yes, political correctness. It's a big problem. So what is your suggestion? I mean, how do we move forward?
Well, we do need to have an open dialogue about it. The question is, what's the best way for that to happen? As a professor, I'd like to think college professors can play an important role by engaging their students in dialogue about these issues rather than shutting them down, whether it be in the classroom or otherwise. I learned about a good example of how a college can do this the other day or a while ago. At the University of Missouri, they had a statue up, or they have a statue up, of Thomas Jefferson. Very well known, he's very well liked, we all know about it. But he has become canceled, or at least his name and the name of some schools, Jefferson High School, for example, have been attempted to be canceled, have the school name changed, because he was a slave owner. And people say, well, he did that, no matter what else he did with his life, this is more important. But what the University of Missouri did is, rather than bow down to the student groups that wanted the statue removed, they basically put up a plaque next to the statue of Jefferson explaining his points of view and why he had that, why he was a slave owner back then. The times were obviously different, but they also educated students about the good things he had done, because maybe they don't understand that. Mm-hmm. So I think it starts with the dialogue, and I'd like to think college, or even earlier than college. We just need to learn how to disagree with each other on issues without being disagreeable, without canceling the other party out.
So I just want to, I agree that, hey, if professors can play a role, that's a great thing. But as we know, only about 32% of our population graduates from college. So it may not have the impact that, you know, would make big changes. Although, let's face it, college professors have a big impact in our lives, more so perhaps in some circles than others. But I also think that one of the things I've noticed in our little community is there are the local news, the really local news, which you really can't debate the local news. You're either having a fire or you're not, and people see it and they rally to help each other, right? It's not one of those things that you argue about or that polarizes you. You just come together as a community. So the local news is really another way of getting past polarization, because it dwells on a verifiable reality that's right in front of you. And that's one of the things that we try to emphasize, is that, you know, emergency preparedness is something we all need to do. It has nothing to do with politics or your party. We just need you to help. Or, you know, if there is an earthquake, how do we respond to each other? Everybody should get, you know, ham radio training or something like that. So, you know, I think one way that you can engage people is on these facts on the ground situations where we're all concerned and it's verifiable, it's right in front of us. And, you know, when you start acting as a community, these political differences make no, you know, they become irrelevant, right? And I have to say that because we lived here in California through this amazing fire not so long ago, it made us realize community is more important than politics. And it made us realize that, you know, responding to local situations in a way helps everybody see each other's humanity, and that you see each other's character, right? It has nothing to do with politics, but just, are you willing to help, right? Are you there?
And that happens with any event of that magnitude, whether it's a fire or school shooting or something of that nature. We tend to come together, but the question is, how long does that exist? And we forget about it over time until the next tragedy occurs, and then come back together. It's not an ongoing thing, I don't think. It can be at a local level, but it's not.
Yeah, no, I think it's easier for it to be an ongoing thing in a very local, rural setting, because you do depend on each other. And there are so many, at least in California, between fires and floods and tsunamis and earthquakes, etc., there's always something to prepare for. So you've got that. But I think one of the other things that's going on, and I don't know if you agree with this, I'd love to hear your take on it, is, you know, people's frustration with inequality, economic inequality, and they feel so left out, and they tend to make enemies of people who are better off. And that is another part of polarization that's going on. And I wonder if you have any ideas on that, how we should address that.
Well, there's no question that people feel left out. Certain groups of people feel left out, that there are those who have made it in society who are wealthy, but others have not made it, perhaps because they haven't been given the opportunity to do so. Certainly, there's a big gap between the wages of those who are, let's say, in charge, certainly those in charge of a big corporation. The average, I write about the average chief executive officer of a corporation makes something like 200 times the amount of salary as an average worker. And we have this in our society, and it's been brought out more, certainly like people like Andrew Yang talks about this. And it just creates more of a division in society. And I don't know, I don't have the magic bullet to make this better, but I think something has to be done so we bring everybody up to a higher level and they're not struggling as much as they are today.
So do you agree with this concept of a universal basic income or a minimum basic income?
Well, I think we've gotten to the point where we have to consider it. I would like to know more about its impact on budget and those sort of things. Mm-hmm. After all, we can't continue to spend and spend and spend and have mm-hmm. no consequences down the road. So I would certainly like to know more about that, what the cost is to society of having a universal basic income. But it could be that the time has come where we need that. in society.
Right.
Things change. Everything's more expensive. And it's hard to keep up, even for the average American, I think. It's hard to keep up.
Right. Well, there has been a decline in wages in real terms for decades. And so I am the parent of three children. I'm a baby boomer. I was very lucky to be participating in an economy that was booming when it did. But my children will never be able to buy homes here. They'll never be able to have the success that we had because, I mean, literally, we could spend a few thousand dollars to get started in the housing market. And that's what we did. And we built from there. That opportunity is not available to our children. So wealth building opportunities are minimal. I mean, buying property is very hard. And then starting a business is also very hard. So things have gotten way harder for the younger generations. And we have to do something to help them. I think possibly canceling student debt is a part of it, or at least some part of that. And the other part of it is make housing available. I mean, I remember in 19, I think it was 74, 76, my husband and I bought a house condo in California for like, it was the down payment was like $3,000.
Yeah.
I know. Can you believe it?
No.
And it's really hard to believe, but the house only cost $32,000. And so it was one of those things where, hey, we just got into the housing market at the right time. And, you know, and that was possible for a baby boomer. You can't do that now. And we have to do something about it. I think the housing crisis is the toughest situation. And it's a true crisis. A lot of young people, well, look at all the homeless people. But aside from the homeless people, look at the people who are spending way too much money on rent, et cetera. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult problem. Yeah. And that's, I think we need to do things like in the old Homestead Act, you know, where you would stake a person for their first down payment so they could at least begin. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Yeah, I know for many years, the idea was for each generation to do better than the previous one.
Yeah.
And as a parent, you wanted your children to do better than you, to have opportunities that you didn't have. That's not there anymore.
It just isn't. I mean, you can't dream that. I know my kids will always be somewhat dependent on me unless they inherit property or inherit land. They're not going to have a stake in the wealth that my generation, the baby boom generation, participates in. So something has to give. Something has to be done. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, one thing I thought about is letting people, these tiny homes, this tiny home idea, you know, where people can build a tiny home, rent a spot in the backyard of some big property, just own that little place. And that's a start where they can then build from there, you know, get that, you know, move to a really nice spot, find some land at some point because they don't have to spend all their money on rent. And then build a house. You know, I mean, I just think we have to give people a way to start building wealth some way. So tiny houses is one possibility. But it's gotten to the point now, like you may have noticed this, people really think that billionaires do not have the right to exist. And that's a thought that never would have crossed my mind. But the inequality is so bad now, so difficult that people are really resentful. And I think that's why they're saying billionaires should not even exist, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. A bit of an extreme view, but yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. And I don't agree with it.
It's all part of a us first, them mentality. And that's where we've gone as a society.
Yeah. It's sad. It's very sad.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have other examples you want to talk about. What do you go through in your book?
Well, I talk about how we could become more ethical people and happier people, have more meaning in our lives if we give to others. Mm. We exercise kindness and empathy toward others. We're open toward other points of view. And I give some examples of people who have done that. But basically, this is where the cancel culture comes in. Because if you are open to dialogue with others about issues that may be contentious, you know, you can gain an understanding of another person's point of view, which is very important. Mm-hmm. You can perhaps gain some prestige within a community for doing so. And adding meaning to your life is all about the way people think about you and your actions. And instead of this cancel culture, it should be an open dialogue. An open dialogue based on free speech, not canceling somebody's mm-hmm. free speech.
Right.
So it all ties back to this issue of ethical behavior, because if we went back to the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated, I don't think anybody would want to be canceled right. by anyone else. So why would you do that to somebody else? That's the issue.
Yeah, because and maybe you explore this in your book, but I guess it's because they stop looking at that person as a human being. Yeah. They start looking at that person as just someone in a group they don't like.
Right.
And exactly. I think so getting down to that person's humanity, actually having one-on-one discussions with people is really critical, right? And how do you do that? I mean, right now we're also so very isolated. I think COVID has made an impact on that, where people stayed in their little bubbles or silos or echo chambers because it was hard to get out, right?
Right.
And so it probably made it more extreme. But yeah, that does say, hey, participate, actually go to meetings and start talking to people about their point of view. Right now that's a big scary idea for some people to just even leave their homes, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although it's changing.
Right. Right. Yeah. It will.
In fact, in San Mateo County, we're 82% vaccinated, all eligible people, 82% of them are vaccinated. By the end of the month, they expect it will be 92%. And then, you know, June 15th, we're supposed to open, which that comes with rules. Meetings have to be at 50% capacity and things like that. But still, there's a way to do it. And so hopefully that can change. So do you have any recommendations as far as what strategies people can take if they want to really make an impact on this problem of cancel culture?
Yeah. Well, I think it's what you said earlier about local. Try to start on a local level. Get involved in a community issue where there may be differences of opinion. Maybe it's affordable housing, for example. Right. And get your voice heard.
Right.
Make sure that people know you're out there, you have a point of view, and be open to other points of view. And as you had said earlier, it's easier on a local level to do that.
Right.
And just like a tiny house may be a way to start in the housing market, the local level of involvement may be a way of getting your voice heard and making a difference.
Yeah. And, you know, what I've read is that even in big cities, there are neighborhoods and there are even just communities within large apartment buildings or large complexes. And there can be a local approach just within a neighborhood. So that's something else people can do. It doesn't have to be just a rural area, right?
No.
I think you can just sort of create a neighborhood watch or something like that, and then get together on that level. And then, you know, you can start to see, hey, we're just all here helping each other out. And if this person disagrees with me on something, they're still a helpful community member. Therefore, they're a human being. Therefore, I am not going to cancel them because I disagree.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an openness to other points of view. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, well, Dr. Mintz, what is the name of your book again? Could you say it?
It's called Beyond Happiness and Meaning. And the subtitle is Transforming Your Life Through Ethical Behavior.
And that sounds like a very interesting book. Now, was it based on any studies? Is it just a philosophical treatise? What is it?
Well, it does have a lot of philosophy in it because we first have to understand what ethics is. Mm-hmm. And people have a different view about ethics. So I talk a lot about if your view is my ethics are my ethics and you can't tell me any different, that's not really what ethical behavior is about. It's about certain norms of behavior, whether it's honesty, trustworthiness, kindness, empathy, these core ethical values that have stood the test of time and how you integrate them into your life. And that can make you a happier person and be seen as a better person within your community, have more meaning in your life. So it all gets back to doing the right thing, whatever that is in a particular situation. So that's kind of how I tie the themes of being ethical and gaining happiness and meaning together.
Okay. And is this book available on Amazon or Kindle or where? What is it?
It's available. Yeah, it's on Amazon, you get paperback or Kindle, and my own website, which is Stephen Mintz, M-I-N-T-Z, Stephen Mintz.
.com?
Yeah, Stephen Mintz Ethics. It's all one word, StephenMintzEthics.com, right. It's available on there, and it's available on Amazon as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when did you, what got you to write that book?
Well, I, in my years as a college professor, my background, the way I got into it was business ethics and accounting ethics. I come from that world. So I retired from Cal Poly about 5 years ago now, and I wanted to try doing something different. So I decided to write a book that was more commercial based rather than academic research based. And as I got into it more and more, I realized there was a need for this kind of book because people don't really understand what ethics is. And as a result, I've done a lot of speaking engagements, interviews like this one, and so on.
Now, when you say people don't understand what ethics, so what are ethics? How would you describe ethics? Why do you say that?
Well, I say it because ethics is knowing the difference between right and wrong. And how do we know that? Well, there are philosophical reasoning methods which tell us, for example, our actions should bring more benefits to other people than harms. Mm-hmm. This is a philosophical method known as utilitarianism, where we emphasize benefits over harms. And that's where the philosophy comes into the book. And I try to give examples. I talk about Edward Snowden, who blew the whistle on the NSA and secretive information. And here's somebody who really did try to do the right thing. He went so far as to leave the country, perhaps for good, as a result of his action trying to hold the NSA accountable for basically its oversight of Americans and our communication without our knowing about it.
Mm-hmm. I am somewhat familiar with his story, not very familiar. I am somewhat familiar with his story. And so do you sympathize with his actions?
Well, I think I do. The more I find out about it, I think initially I was skeptical as to why he was doing this, whether there was some benefit to him. But I realized over time it was the way he felt deeply about the NSA listening into our conversations and things like that without telling us about it. And he thought it was wrong. And he thought, taken to an extreme, sort of a big brother is watching phenomenon. So once I realized he had good intentions, and that's what ethics is a lot about, your intention. Is your intention good to make things better? Right. Obviously not worse. And right. I realized he did have positive intentions as I watched more and more interviews of him, read things about him. So I became much more sympathetic to his cause, which I think is probably true of most Americans, where in the beginning, we probably wanted to cancel him over time and with meaning and understanding, which is what we should be doing to counteract the cancel culture. We realized he was just a person, an average person, who happened to have access to information that can make lives better for all Americans.
Hmm. And do you go into this in your book at all? Do you study this particular case as an example? Okay.
I do. I have a handful of cases where people acted the right way, the wrong way, and I analyze why from an ethical point of view. I mean, an extreme case of somebody who probably deserved to be canceled is his fellow Bernie Madoff, who cheated his investors, you know, out of billions of dollars of money by lying to them about the investments he was making with their money, and he was really stealing it for his own good.
Yeah.
And I think ethics are best learned through examples rather than by lecturing others. Examples provide a good foundation.
Well, those are extreme examples. I mean, Bernie Madoff, I think everyone would agree, was a bad guy. But I think Edward Snowden is more of a controversial figure because people say he also exposed some of the names of the CIA agents who were, or some agent who was involved with this. And so they want to cancel him on that basis alone. And you're saying, no, you've got to look at the big picture. Is that right?
I agree with that. Right. I'm not saying it's a good idea to signal someone out as he did. I'm not saying that at all. But on balance, his actions were more helpful than hurtful. I really think there's a new sensitivity in the country about oversight and surveillance by NSA and such agencies.
Interesting. Yeah. So can I ask you about yourself? Where do you live, Mr.? What kind of a situation do you live? Are you in a city or a rural area or what?
Well, I live outside of San Luis Obispo.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, you know,
that's where Cal Poly is. Yeah, Cal Poly was your college, right?
Right, right. It's, you know, a small, nice coastal town, mostly college students. Mm-hmm. But I've lived in big cities all my life. So I'm familiar with that as well. In retirement age, I just felt like an environment such as San Luis Obispo was better for me.
Yeah, I was there recently. I was stopped there on a drive down to San Diego, and it's just gorgeous. I went to Cambria. We went to go see the elephant seals. We shopped in the little town. There's all these cute little boutiques. It's a really darling area. We were in Avila Beach for the night. Yeah. That's just gorgeous. So, that's a sweet spot in California. There are many. So, Dr. Mintz, I appreciate your time. Is there anything in particular you would like to emphasize about your book?
Yeah, I just think that we have to be open to other points of view. Open to other people, whether it's from a point of view of political leanings, which is what we've been talking about today, or, you know, we could take it down to race and nationality. We need to get back as a country to realizing we are all people. We may have other different objectives, but most people are trying to do the right thing most of the time. And we need to understand that and basically use it as a model for our own behavior. Just understanding and openness to other points of view, because it's just been closed off through this cancel culture.
It's a message we do need to be reminded of. And, I guess especially now that fewer and fewer people are attending religious services or feeling as though they belong to a particular faith, We have to learn ethics in a different way, perhaps, but it seems so basic to say that we just have to treat other people like human beings, but
yes,
we have to be reminded of that. So,
yes.
So, well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Dr. Mintz, and I hope that, and I think you're right. This is a basic message that people need to be reminded about. So thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And I enjoyed the conversation. I might even just go get your book.
Please do.
Yes. Because I like the idea of case studies, of examples. Yeah. I think that makes it easier to absorb. So it sounds like it would be interesting.
Yes.
So again, I appreciate your time. And
thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. This is KPDO 89.3 FM, serving Pescadero on the South Coast. My guest today was Dr. Stephen Mintz, who has written a book on ethics, Beyond Happiness and Meaning, Transforming Ourselves Through Ethical Behavior. So it's an interesting topic that we probably need to revisit from time to time.